Welcome back, everyone. It's 1:30. I see most of our members are here. We actually do have a significant presentation to walk through, so I will kick this off. Those couple of folks that are not here will join us a little later. So I will turn it over to, for the last time, Chair Pappalardo for Groundfish. Knock yourself out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Groundfish Committee report today has three parts. First, we have Framework Adjustment 74, which is the action item before the Council today. This is the framework that would initiate work on fishing years 2027 through 2031 specifications and related management measures. It includes the core specifications work and several sub-ACL and accountability measures, and a few administrative cleanup items that are intended to better align with the regulations, to better align the regulations with how the programs are actually operating. Second, we will receive a brief update on Framework 68 and the ABC control rule work. That work continues to be closely connected to the Council's risk policy work and the broader effort to make our specifications process more transparent, repeatable, and responsive to uncertainty. Third, we will receive an overview of the Amendment 23 monitoring review. I want to emphasize at the front end that there is no decision before the Council today on Amendment 23. The purpose today is to hear the PDT's draft review, ask questions, and help shape what information the Council will need when it later considers whether any follow-up action is warranted. On Framework 74, the committee met jointly with the AP and Recreational Advisory Panel on June 10th. The committee recommends that the Council initiate Framework 74, and that motion passed unanimously without objection at the committee. At this time, I'll ask staff to deliver their presentation.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Robin Friede, Council staff of the Groundfish, Groundfish Plan Coordinator, and I'm also joined with by Mark Grant here, also Council staff working on Groundfish. I will lead us through the Framework 74 discussion. I believe we'll pause then for questions, discussion, and motions, and then Mark will be leading the remaining two topics on Framework 68 and our Amendment 23 review. And so just to point out, we do have our updated Groundfish quarterly outlook, one of your materials, and just highlighting those three topics we'll discuss today, but putting into context the large amount of Groundfish priorities this year. The Groundfish PDT committee have already accomplished quite a bit this year, and we're kind of in that period there where there's a lot of overlapping priorities and looking ahead to the second half of the year. And so we'll again begin with Framework 74, receiving a report from the PDT on the draft scope and alternatives, including some recommendations from the PDT on some considerations for alternatives to include and looking to initiate the action. And so for the draft scope for Framework 74, this is, as noted, for fishing years 2027 through 2031, specifications and management measures. We typically include as a placeholder the potential for any revised status determination criteria, should there be any coming out of updated assessments. I'm not currently aware of any at this time, but just including that just in case as part of the scope. And then you see several bullets here. It probably looks like maybe more than is actually here, and just as we're sort of specifying the different lengths of specifications anticipating specified for certain stocks, a lot of this related to the transboundary managed stocks. And so we'll also be looking at, for the scope, setting the total allowable catches, the TACs for the U.S.-Canada management units, and in recent years we've been setting as a single year, so fishing year 2027, TACs for the Eastern Georges Bank cod and Eastern Georges Bank haddock management units. There is interest from TMGC to set two-year specifications, total allowable catches for the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder stock, so that would be 2027 through 2028 fishing years. And so then correspondingly setting the specifications for those full stocks, so 2027 specifications for Georges Bank cod and Georges Bank haddock, and then the 2 years for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. And then the remaining stocks listed here would be looking at, as we've started doing last year, setting longer five-year specifications. So fishing year 2027 through 2031 for stocks that plan to have updated specifications, either resulting from assessments or data updates. So Gulf of Maine haddock, American Place, Witch Flounder, Pollock, Northern and Southern Windowpane Flounders, and Atlantic Halibut. Along with that, the PDT would conduct the review of the subcomponent analysis, and we will typically focus on those stocks listed here for revised specifications, could get to others time permitting. As part of the FMP, we do have a review process that occurs for the Georges Bank Haddock sub-ACL and the Midwater Trawl Herring Fishery whenever there's a full Georges Bank Haddock assessment, so we do have that planned for this year. And you'll see later there's some considerations offered regarding that. And then an item that's sort of a cleanup from, or just a follow-up from last year, when through Framework 72, we Council had set Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic, Yellowtail Flounder specifications, including the scallop fishery sub-ACL, needed to use a different approach just based on not having the bycatch estimates available during the decision-making time. There was a decision from the PDT and committee to potentially revisit that, or at least kind of check in on whether that approach would need any revisit. So may not necessarily be any changes here, but just kind of inventorying all of the things that the PDT might work on this year. And then finally, looking at simplifying the criteria for reducing the size of the Southern Windowpane Flounder accountability measures area. And so taking that scope and putting it into what a draft range of alternatives would look like. So there would be a section for an action one on if there were revised status determination criteria. Action two would be this revised specifications, all of those items previously just walked through. And then the action three on the commercial fishery management measures, the Southern Windowpane Flounder accountability measures. This would be a kind of a narrowly focused measure that would simplify this criteria for a provision that's an existing provision to reduce the size of the accountability measure area so that if the large AM has been triggered and the stock is rebuilt, only the small AM area is implemented. And this would be for both the groundfish fishery and the large mesh non-groundfish trawl fisheries. And I'll get more into that in a later slide. For a draft timeline, so the rows highlighted in red are the council milestones. So today, looking at the council initiating the framework, identifying the scope and likely range of alternatives, we'd expect an update in September. That would generally be on development of draft alternatives for some of the management measure alternatives, as alternatives related to specifications would typically be occurring after September once we started to get the results of the assessments and move forward with our SSC meetings and recommendations for those stocks with revised specifications, and then looking to December for final action, resuming the whole range of alternatives, taking final action, subsequently then council staff finalizing the document, submitting and targeting May 1 implementation. Just noting a few upcoming meetings. So next week, we do have a peer review for the June management track assessments, and that does include Georges Bank Haddock, also Atlantic Herring, as was noted yesterday. Georges Bank Haddock is scheduled for the first day, June 29th, and it was noted yesterday for anyone who is planning to attend in person, there's been a meeting location change, and so just to look for that or follow up if you have any questions. There's also an online component. And then we do anticipate peer review for management track assessments that we'll have in September. That will be for Gulf of Maine Haddock and American Place, kind of switched timing where that is now occurring after the September council meeting. We'll later then have our Transboundary Management Guidance Committee meeting for the transboundary management units in October, and then our SSC meetings for all of the stocks that will have revised specifications. So other stocks noted here will have data updates we anticipate receiving. That would be Witch Flounder and Atlantic Halibut. Pollock will be kind of a new case study this year where we'll have a stock with a data update but looking to update the projections. And then the windowpane flounder stocks, these had data updates that were received by the council last year. The council decided to, per the PDT's recommendation, defer updating specifications on the windowpane flounders until this year since they had specifications in place. And so we'll be visiting those this year. And so to provide a bit more context on the Southern Windowpane Flounder accountability measure item for inclusion here, and so just prior, a few weeks or so before the April Council meeting and the Groundfish Committee meeting that occurred before then, the Council received from GARFO the fishing year 2024 final year-end catch accounting, which included notice a letter from GARFO indicating that the southern windowpane flounder, there had been an overage in 2024 for both the groundfish fishery, and then we have a other subcomponent we call our large mesh non-groundfish trawl fisheries component, and so that is expecting to then trigger the accountability measures. And so those measures apply again to the groundfish trawl vessels, and then the non-groundfish trawl vessels, this is gear-based, so it's vessels fishing with cod ends 5-inch mesh or greater. These are gear-based, gear-restricted areas, so vessels, when these are implemented, are required to use approved selective gear, haddock separator trawl, reel trawl, or rope separator trawl. And so there's the figure here is showing the AM areas, just to mostly focus on the fact that that darker gray shaded area, those two 10-minute squares, that is the small accountability measure area. And then there are also large accountability measure areas in different areas that apply to either the groundfish fishery and or the large mesh non-groundfish trawl fisheries. And so there is a provision in the FMP, part of the accountability measures, that allows the potential to reduce the size of the AM area implemented if the large AM is triggered, to then instead implement the small area. And that requires two criteria to be met, the stock to be rebuilt, and then meeting a biomass criteria. And that biomass criteria is defined as the three-year centered average of the most recent, the three most recent surveys. And that's multiplied by the reference point, the 75% FMSY from the most recent assessment, and then looking to see whether that is greater than the fishing year catch. And so what was indicated from the letter from GARFO is that based on the 2024 overage, that biomass criterion was not met, and so therefore the large accountability measure would be triggered. To note, there's also a provision to reduce the duration of the AM on or after September 1st if the year two ACL is not exceeded. So in this case, based on 2024 overage, if the 2025 ACL is not exceeded, the AM can potentially be reduced either on or before or after September 1st when that information is available, typically in the fall when the year-end catch accounting becomes available and takes a little bit longer for some of the information on the other fisheries compared to the groundfish fishery to become available. But to note, to be clear, this discussion that occurred at the April Council meeting was based on an understanding, based on the information received and the regulations that the accountability measures would be implemented beginning May 1 of fishing year 2026. But they have not yet been implemented, so that it does require NIMS to publish a notice, and that has not occurred yet. And so the discussion that occurred at the April Council meeting, a lot of this occurred under public comments, and then a council had a discussion under other business again with the anticipation that the accountability measures had been triggered and expect to be implemented for this fishing year. And hearing a lot of comments, a lot of concerns from stakeholders from multiple fisheries that expect to be impacted by the accountability measures, also shoreside businesses on the large anticipated economic impacts. And the council heard all of this and passed the following motion to recommend including in what will be initiated today as Framework 74, an alternative that looks at modifying this accountability measure trigger for the southern windowpane flounder AMs so that the criteria for determining if you can have a reduction in the size of the area is the stock being rebuilt. So when the stock is rebuilt, only the small AM area is applied. So effectively, just having one criteria instead of both the rebuilt and that separate biomass criteria that need to be met. And this would be for both groundfish fishery and the large mesh non-groundfish fisheries. And so the rationale provided the hope that this would be a way to apply a more efficient way to reduce the size of the AM that might be necessary to account for overages. Having both of those criteria might be a bit redundant or overly restrictive, and to try to provide some economic relief to the fishing industry. Identifying and recognizing that this would be kind of a short-term temporary way to address and reduce the size of the impacts from the AM, while some of these larger conversations around management of southern windowpane flounder occur. And by making this change or looking at considering this change in this Framework 74, and the soonest this could potentially be available would be fishing year 2027, but the council had a discussion about kind of recognizing or hoping that NIMS would recognize and consider this as they're working towards implementing the AM for fishing year 2026. And so really intending to kind of serve as a bridge to now some of the future planned work, and some of that work is ongoing. We'll be receiving an update tomorrow on one of the Inflation Reduction Act projects, looking at ecosystem component species, evaluation of which southern window pane flounder is a candidate, as well as considering some of the priorities that are work identified around the Executive Order 14276, potential to have revisions to reactive accountability measures. Both of these items potentially being things that could be taken up as 2027 priorities. And so you also have in your materials a memo from the plan development team, and this was some of the discussion at the most recent committee and advisory panel joint meeting. Some additional considerations for recommendations to include in Framework 74 scope, some of these being mainly administrative measures around regulatory cleanup and streamlining for a couple of programs in the groundfish plan. So these were items that were identified included within the as part of the suite of recommendations for the executive order 14276. And the PDT is recognizing that really there's longer term, broader, bigger conversations to be had, and probably desirable to have a broader holistic regulatory cleanup action to consider the utility of some of these programs. But by considering some administrative changes potentially to include in Framework 74, these administrative changes being a temporary way to help address some challenges seen recently with implementation of these programs, reducing some of the workload, thinking about the time needed to work through rulemaking, and also just better align with kind of how these programs have been operating in recent years. So the first being the regular B Days at Sea program. So the kind of the issue here is that this program has been closed annually for quite some time, due to just having very low quota that's allocated incidental catch tack. You heard about this yesterday during the GARFRA report. So this continuing to be closed is not a change from what we've seen in recent years, but this does require an annual determination by the regional administrator and also a notification in the Federal Register to implement. And so a suggested administrative change to be considered in Framework 74 would be to essentially flip this around and change the administration so that the default would be that this is closed, unless the RA were to determine that there is sufficient quota to allow that program to be open. So alleviating some of the rulemaking bottleneck that can occur leading up to May 1, ensuring the program remains closed when necessary, and again, more aligning with how things have actually been operating. Kind of similarly with closed Area 2 Yellowtail Flounder Haddock Special Access Program, or SAP, and another item that was noted yesterday during the GARFRA report. So this program also requires an annual determination by the RA, as well as a notification in the Federal Register of whether the program, the special access program, is open in that upcoming fishing year to target yellowtail flounder or to target haddock. And there's different requirements with each of those modes in terms of required gear and seasons. So the default is to have this program be open to target yellowtail flounder, but for almost a decade, the determination has been made to open to target haddock. There's the details are provided in the PDT memo, but the determination, kind of the calculation of when the program could be open to target yellowtail requires a quota that can support 150 trips with a 15,000 pound trip limit for yellowtail flounder, which has been quite some time since that has happened. So kind of similarly, this is flipped a little bit around in terms of how it's administered with how things are actually operating. So the suggestion here would be to look at modifying the administration of the SAP so that the target haddock, that would be the default status, the default mode, wouldn't require these declarations and publishing in the notification, eliminating some of that build up to the May 1, and does have some timing considerations to make sure the fishing industry knows, you know, which of those modes that this program is under in operating for the upcoming fishing year. And also some consideration just to update the naming conventions. It's fairly confusing, difficult to write out. It's clearly written in a time when yellowtail flounder was more of the targeting, and it's certainly not the case anymore. There's also been, as SFD staff have noted, misinterpretation that can occur from unfamiliar readers who often or have been interpreting open to target haddock, meaning only harvest haddock, which is not the case. So just trying to clean up and improve some of the understanding of what this program actually does too. And so finally, kind of another administrative type action to consider. So as noted, the Georges Bank Haddock Midwater Trawl Herring Fishery Sub-ACL do have a process that requires this review whenever there's a full Georges Bank Haddock assessment, which is occurring this year. And the PDT is recommending a consideration in Framework 74 to look at setting the sub-ACL to remain at the fixed percentage amount, for example, the current 2%, and discontinue this requirement to review the sub-ACL. So currently what happens that when the review occurs, then a recommendation from the PDT goes to the committee. Should that change, it can be anywhere from 1 to 2% of the sub-ACL, and it does require that determination be made when this review is going through, when there's a full Georges Bank Haddock assessment. And just thinking about looking at recent herring midwater trawl fishery catches of Georges Bank Haddock, been very low. We've seen much lower effort in the herring fishery in recent years, kind of calling into question the real need to have this required review, and eliminating the review and still have and setting a fixed percentage allocation amount. This would be more consistent with how we monitor groundfish catches in other fisheries, for for example, scallops and small mesh, as well as the fact there is a Gulf of Maine haddock sub-ACL from the midwater trawl herring fishery, and that is just set as a fixed percentage allocation approach. And so this still preserves the process where the PDT continues to monitor catches, can make recommendations to the council as appropriate, but would sort of remove that requirement from the review. And you know, there was some discussion yesterday, some of the other contexts in terms of how the herring committee is considering catch caps and kind of issues around haddock as well. So these were posed as discussion questions for the committee, and both advisory panels met, consider the PDT's recommendations on including these administrative measures and recommending the items to include. There was general support for including all the administrative measures as recommended by the PDT. This, again, these could be sort of shorter term things that could be helpful to improve administration, wouldn't have a large analytical lift, and kind of bridge towards some larger, more holistic actions. There were also a number of concerns raised on Atlantic halibut, and so recognizing, looking at the preliminary groundfish fishery catches for fishing year 2025 we have available, and anticipating a likely overage, concerns about the impacts and the accountability measures. I do have some extra slides on those. Just a reminder, they're gear-based, gear-restricted areas for the accountability measures that affect the groundfish fishery, and then there is a zero possession accountability measure that affects a much larger suite of permits, so groundfish fishery and a whole host of all federal permit holders. So a lot of concerns around this potential overage and the effects of the accountability measures, and discussion around different potential options to try to address this. Another theme here is just, as you I think have heard in other reports, the discussion around the kind of recommendation for clean, streamlined specifications actions and versus management measures and some of the considerations around that. So we do have committee motion, and I think some additional motions to come up and address some of those discussion points, both for halibut as well as that southern windowpane flounder accountability measure trigger change. And so with that, I think we can stop and take any questions on Framework 74, and then we can get into the motions that we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Feedy. To the council, any questions on the presentation? And then we will go to your committee motion, Mr. Pappalardo. Great job. So I will turn to Mr. Pappalardo with the committee motion.
Yeah, before I read this, I just want to let everyone know I object to this long motion being as long as it is. Although I will note that it's coming from the Mass Division of Marine Fisheries, I'm pretty sure it's I guess you could consider it a Pierce Light motion. And I had suggested a two-sentence alternative, but unfortunately this is what I'm now being asked to read into the record. So Let's put it up here. Okay, on behalf of the committee, recommend to the council to initiate framework adjustment 74 to include fishing year 2027 through 2031 specifications and management measures as revised status determination criteria is appropriate, set FY 2027 total allowable catches for U.S. Canada management units of Eastern Georgia's cod, Eastern Georgia's haddock, fishing year 27-28 tax for Georgia's bank yellowtail flounder. Set the 27 specs for Georgia's cod and haddock, 27 through 28 specs for Georgia's yellowtail flounder, 27 through 31 specifications for Gulf of Maine haddock, American Place, Witch Flounder, Pollock, Northern Windowpane Flounder, Southern Windowpane Flounder, and Atlantic Halibut. Review subcomponent analysis for stocks with revised specifications and others as time permits. Review GB Haddock sub-ACL on the Midwater Trawl Herring Fishery. Set the sub-ACL at a fixed percentage amount and discontinue the review requirement. Reevaluate approach used for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Yellowtail Flounder Scallop Fishery sub-ACL. Modify the criteria for the provisions of the Southern Windowpane Flounder accountability measures to reduce the size of the AM area for the groundfish fishery and large mesh non-groundfish trawl fisheries. Adjust administration of the B Days at Sea program and closed area 2 yellowtail flounder haddock SAP to change the default status and reevaluate and potentially modify Atlantic halibut accountability measures.
Thank you for that. And while you catch your breath back, this is a committee motion, does not need a second. I will go to Ms. Griffin.
First, in my defense, the chairman's suggestion was received after the motion. So I do have a motion to amend. And unfortunately, I do need to reread it. Yes, the whole thing. I'm looking at. No? Okay, good. Yes.
Just the part that you're amending.
Excellent. Although they don't seem to be highlighted, so I'll try to walk us through this. Let's see. So this is a motion to amend, thank you, specifically for the southern windowpane AMs and the halibut measures. So in one, two, three, four, five, the sixth bullet is set fishing year 2027 to fishing year 2031 specifications for Atlantic halibut, exploring sources of best available science to support catch setting methods. And then in the 10th bullet, it is revising the southern windowpane priority to be simplify the criteria for reducing the size of the southern windowpane flounder accountability measures area.
Aren't you lucky? Looking for a second on the motion. Ms. Ware. Rationale?
Yeah, so again, this amends language to better characterize proposed measures for southern windowpane and Atlantic halibut in a way that should help us keep this framework, Framework 74, a clean specs action and on time.
Ms. Ware, anything else?
Yeah, I just will speak to the halibut a little bit, and I appreciate the discussion we had at committee. As best as I can discern, I think this is the best path forward, because I do think the AMs are a symptom of the problem, not the underlying problem. I think our challenge is we have Canadian and U.S. assessments of halibut that are giving very divergent perspectives right now, and as that gap widens, we're getting bigger and bigger deductions on the Canadian catch to the U.S. quota. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest they're all one stock. So I think we need to be focused on that, and I think this motion reflects that. I know we've taken previous action in, I think it was Framework 66, to try and patchwork together a slightly different trigger, and that held us together for a few years, but I think we're at a point where we need to be considering other ways to approach Atlantic halibut, and I think this motion reflects that. Thanks.
Thank you for that. To the motion to amend on the board, Mr. Alexander and then Ms. O'Dell.
Yeah, for a nice clean specs motion, this one here has its complications, and I'm trying to figure out, is this something we could get done before December and take final action on it, so we'll have specs in place by May 1st? Looking for
Ms. Friede?
Some sort of an answer to that.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So I'll start with maybe the window pane flounder measure. I think we've had some recognition that this is intended to be very narrowly focused on changing a trigger in an existing provision. Generally should be fairly simplified and kind of could be considered within a more of a clean specs action, and is something we would be able to complete by December. We kind of have really an existing body of analysis to work with there. We're just simplifying an existing measure. So that one is more straightforward. And then on halibut, as was noted, the concern, I think, looking more into revising the accountability measures is leading you farther away from a clean specs action. There was less, I think, at the committee meeting direction on where that might be. But I think what's also recognized is the, you know, a way that could actually address some of the issues is that better addressed through looking at options for how we are setting catch advice. And we've started to have some conversations between staff and the PDT. I think we will still expect having the halibut data update received while we're kind of developing some of these potential additional methods, but are working towards that for December final action. And then while it looks like a lot of stuff here, a lot of this is really just specifications. The only other ones being those sort of administrative ones we added, which wouldn't really expect to be either outside of a clean specs type action nor a large analytical lift. I'll see if maybe our executive director has anything else to add, but that's kind of our characterization of the measures here.
Dr. O'Keefe?
Just to follow up on Ms. Freedy's comments, back to Mr. Alexander. Yes, I mean, a lot of this, it looks like a lot, but a lot of it is administrative in nature, not a lot of analysis time. However, the second part of your question is, will we have specs in place by May 1st? And I think that that's far out of our purview to really understand. We could try to keep this as narrowly focused as possible and still not have things in place by the start of the fishing year.
Terry?
Yeah, well, so I was under the impression the halibut was going to take a considerable time longer than what we thought. Is it less complicated than what we thought now? Just because I'm just looking for some sort of hint of what that actually looks like.
Yeah, exactly. So halibut could certainly take a lot longer, especially pursuing revisions to accountability measures. And I think recognizing that there are some longer-term avenues, we could look at that future council action to revise accountability measures more holistically, think about alternative management. That would take quite a bit longer, but by focusing more on the specification setting part of it, looking at some potential other ways to explore basing the setting of catch advice, that's more feasible within this timeline. So hopefully that helps clarify.
Ms. O'Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Robin, can you, I was going to ask this when you first gave your presentation, but so just to have a clear understanding of the source of our specifications that are coming in this year for groundfish, we have, you had mentioned pollock and witch flounder and one other stock, now it might be halibut, that we got moved down to that bullet, is going to have a data update. But there was an asterisk in your presentation to say it's a data update with updated projections. Is that what you had said? So is that
just pollock is the one that we anticipate for data update with updated projections?
Okay. Is that typical of a data update that we would have? Just trying to understand what scientific products we're actually or reviews we're getting for these stocks. Thanks.
Thanks for the question, and it's timely. The NRCC had a discussion about trying to be a little bit more transparent and put some clarification around the definitions of what these things are. So I would direct anybody to the NRCC page on the council's website, which now does include definitions of the different things. So what is a data update? What's a data update with projections? What's a management track assessment or research track? And the real difference between a data update and a data update with projections is a data update really just provides updated data, and it's mostly focused on surveys and fishery catch. Some other things can be included upon request. data update with projections, takes the most recent fishery catch and projects forward. It doesn't change the model, it doesn't rerun a stock assessment, but it provides projections out forward. But I would strongly recommend there is standard language now on the website to try to describe what these things are.
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Robin.
I'll just add, I think, and this is maybe back to Mr. Alexander's question, kind of similarly with the southern windowpane flounder, where we're kind of looking at things that we could try to look at this year, the short term, but we're recognizing there's longer term priorities, looking more holistically at management. The exploring of catch advice setting for halibut, I expect this will be, you know, we're going to start that this year, but there will be some, you know, longer term consideration with some of those other ongoing priorities, if that just helps to characterize it for you as well.
Back to you, Ms. O'Dell.
That was my first question, was just to have a clear understanding on what these, what data we were getting or what information we were getting for the specifications. The second request I had is, Robin, you had just mentioned that you have additional slides that just to show the council members what those accountability measures are right now for that are on the books for halibut. And I was wondering if it would be possible just to show that so that folks are aware of what those are. I had to go back when this issue came up in the spring for the Southern New England windowpane flounder. I had to go back and look at those boxes and the shaded boxes, the large and the small area. And I think it's important for folks on the council to be reminded of what those AMs are. If the Canadian catch is larger that we anticipate it's going to be, what will happen to the U.S. fishery? Because it's pretty significant for fixed gear and for the trawl fleet. The area for the trawl fleet is pretty significant. So I want folks to be able to look at it and realize what that is. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Well, oh, and there it is. So I will also note the council has modified the accountability measures, I think, several times. I think Ms. Ware spoke to this. There's sort of been a stepwise patchwork trying to address concerns around impacts on halibut and kind of the scope of the larger question around stock structure, assessments, sources of catch advice between the U.S. assessment and the DFO Canadian assessment. We had an action a few years ago to try to think about some ways to it was characterized as minimizing some of the impacts of the large swings in Canadian catch that's included and seemed to work for a while. And again, we're kind of reaching a point where needs maybe a different set of approaches here. But just to review the accountability measures, and these were modified most recently in Framework 57. So they consist for the groundwater fishery, a seasonal gear-restricted area. The purple one here is a trawl AM area. So trawl vessels, groundwater fishery, they have to use selective gear. Year-round, it's a bit hard to see, but there's like a little dashed line. That's a seasonal area where, for a portion of time, April 1st through July 31st, they don't have to use the selective gear. And then there's a gillnet accountability measure area, that small purple box farther north, where fixed gear is not allowed between the months of March through October. These were modified. There had been additional areas, and longline fishery used to be involved, but there were some modifications in 57. The other major part of the accountability measures is then goes to no possession. So currently, groundfish fishery vessels are allowed to keep one halibut per trip. This would go to no possession, but not just for the groundfish fishery. It would apply to a much broader suite, so all federally permitted vessels. And this was another change made in Framework 57. Really the concern being that the accountability measure at that time, just having that no possession apply to the groundfish fishery, wasn't capturing some of the larger, the other fisheries, state fisheries and other fisheries that can account for halibut catches. So this would then apply to scallop vessels, lobster vessels, HMS general category vessels, as well as Northeast multi-species category C and D, limited access monkfish permit holders. And this is the part that always involves a lot of questions, but basically if there is an exemption, a permit holder has exclusively a party charter or an HMS angling category or HMS charter headboat, only those and not any other. They are exempt from it. If they have any of the other commercial permits, it does apply. So that's the suite of, I think, recognizing some of the impacts that have been their concerns, both in the groundfish fishery and some of these other fisheries. It's the gear restricted areas and then the no possession.
Thank you for that, Ms. Friede. Y'all set, Jackie? Because I want to get back to the motion on the board.
I am. So I just want to make sure I have an understanding of what the change is now in the bullet for halibut.
So basically on the motion, if we can get that up, is exploring different alternatives, different data coming in to actually set the specifications. We're not going to look at anything about the actual AM in itself. This is more to find other data sources that are the best available science to allow us to set the specifications moving forward for this next cycle on Atlantic halibut.
So that will be moving forward, but what do we do if there's an overage from the year prior?
Dr. O'Keefe.
Thanks. So a couple of things. It's a little premature to say exactly what we're going to bring together for best available science around halibut, which is why the language in this amended motion is a little bit vague. But there's a body of evidence that suggests that the U.S. halibut stock is not an isolated population from the much larger Scotian shelf stock that is mostly in Canadian waters. So moving this year, we are trying to put information together to say that catch has been misspecified because the population assumption has been violated. If we say that the catch is misspecified, then there is no reason to implement the AM. And so that's why focusing on the catch setting approach keeps us in a specifications package, and we can try to get it done on time. Tinkering with the AM could make it a larger analysis, delay it, and you would have that AM kick in on May 1st. Yeah.
Thank you for that clarification, and thank you for walking us through the AMs. Ms. Friede?
Yeah, I don't want to belabor it, but just to, I think Ms. Ware had said it, this is trying to treat the underlying issue and not just the symptom. Further, I think just to kind of think through, it's not immediately clear even some of the revisions to the accountability measures would really be available here or how you could even address just the process question. There's some other challenges here. So just to add a little bit more there.
Okay, so we have a motion on the board to amend. I think we've got some clarity around these two bullet points. Are there any further comments, questions to the maker, seconder on the motion to amend from the council? Seeing none, I will go out to the audience on the motion to amend. In the room? Online? Back to the council? Is there any objection to the motion to amend on the board? Any abstentions? Seeing none, the motion to amend will pass with full consensus. Now this becomes the main motion as amended. Hope we're all set here. This as the main motion as amended. Is there any objections to the motion as amended? Seeing none, any abstentions? Seeing none, the motion as amended will pass by unanimous consent. Back to staff for continue the presentation.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Grant, and like Robin, I'm council staff. And so I will be presenting the remainder of this presentation. So I hope you all had a little bit of caffeine this afternoon. Also, with or without these glasses, I can't see that screen up there. So please don't be offended that I'm staring at my laptop. Yeah. Okay. So first we're going to talk about framework adjustment 68, which is about ABC control rules. So for today, I'm going to give you a brief review of past work on framework 68 before the council paused its work to first revise its risk policy. I'm going to talk a little bit about how this relates to what is going on with the council's risk policy work and then next steps. So after this agenda item, the council will have a presentation on risk policy and will set the bounds for the risk tolerance tiers, low, intermediate, high, on the Z-score curve. I'm not going to get into that in detail. Afterwards, you're also going to be conducting a global factor weighting exercise that will be used by all fishery management plans. And then this summer, the plan development team will score the factors with the most recent scientific information available. And so this is just sort of a flowchart graphic showing how all that will be progressing. So now I'm going to give you a few slides that come from our colleagues at the University of Maine who are working on simulations for potential new groundfish ABC control rules, which would incorporate your new risk policy. You saw these slides as part of a presentation at your April meeting, which is part of why I'm only showing you a subset of them today. So the council currently uses two distinct approaches for determining scientific uncertainty buffers. The groundfish FMP currently uses A, which is a fixed percentage of the OFL. And then the scallop and whiting plans currently use version B, which is something called P star, and it's an acceptable probability of overfishing. And then here, just recapping that risk policy process on the left, and then how it will integrate with ABC control rules on the right. So we'll have the factor weights from the council. PDTs will do factor scoring with data, combine that to get a single Z score. We then look at that in terms of the council's risk policy, and then that goes through the ABC control rule. So the UMAE team is working on developing options for the groundfish ABC control rules. Currently, they're looking at three options in addition to the current set. The team will use management strategy evaluation to test the different options and then to compare them using simulation testing. Potential performance metrics that they'll use for those comparisons for the different ABC control rules include how responsive the control rule results are to changing conditions, stock sustainability, both stock status and rebuilding times, and harvest opportunities, catch advice, and realized catch. And then this work coming out of that University of Maine team will be incorporated into Framework 68. You'll probably see those results at a groundfish committee meeting in August. So let's get back into Framework 68. Framework 68 is about acceptable biological control rules, ABC control rules. Sometimes you hear people talk about harvest control rules, and basically the difference is that ABC control rules are just a subset of harvest control rules, where harvest control rules are predefined general management actions taken in response to fish stock status, like, you know, reducing fishing if biomass is low. ABC control rules are a specific subset, which are about setting the ABC by reducing the OFL to account for scientific uncertainty. So here's a little history on your past work. The council added development of revised groundfish ABC control rules to priorities in 2023, and in June of 2023, Framework 68 was initiated. In August of 2023, there was a facilitated meeting to discuss draft goals and objectives, and that had participants from the Groundfish Committee, the SSC, the Groundfish PDT, the Advisory Panel, the Recreational Advisory Panel, the Risk Policy Working Group, and the public. And then the council decided to pause development of Framework 68 to first revise its risk policy. And so the council approved its revised risk policy statement and concept back in September of 2024. Implementation of that began back on January 1st of 2025. And then in 2025 and in 2026, you've continued development of the risk policy concept. And then there's that ongoing simulation testing of potential ABC control rules that I just referenced that's being done by the folks at University of Maine. So, goals and objectives for Framework 68 is to modify or replace the existing groundfish control rules to better address the goals and objectives of the fishery management plan, considering increasing uncertainty and variability in stock assessments, changing environmental conditions, and the national standard guidelines. The new control rules should produce catch advice that prevents overfishing, rebuilds stocks, improves attainment of optimum yield, and seeks to minimize large changes in catch advice as appropriate. From an objective standpoint, develop a tiered groundfish ABC control rule which considers but is not limited to stock status, including unknown and rebuilt, stock assessment model type and sources or level of uncertainty, productivity regime, stability in ABCs with decision rules for when to use constant ABCs and the ability to use phased-in ABCs consistent with updated National Standard 1 guidelines. So on this slide where we're going to talk a bit about approach, we've used the simple rubric of blue and yellow makes green. So in blue, we're showing what we expect to consider in Framework 68. Yellow, we highlight what's incorporated in the risk policy, and green is where we see some overlap. So since the development of the goals and objectives, some topics the committee and council are interested in have been incorporated into the revised risk policy. So in Framework 68, we're going to develop a tiered groundfish ABC control rule that will consider stock status, stock assessment model type, uncertainty and productivity regime, and you'll see those are all things in your risk policy. Framework 68, the control rule should also consider stability in the ABCs. That's an overlap with decision rules for when to use constant ABCs and the ability to use phased in ABCs. And so inclusion of the National Standard 1 guidelines for phased in ABCs, ABC carryover provisions, and also looking at constant ABCs adds tools for stability. So next steps for Framework 68. Today, you'll be approving your revised risk policy concept. You're going to conduct that weighting exercise and discuss use of the new risk policy. The contractors at UMaine will continue to work on multiple ABC control rule approaches, including simulations. And then the PDT will start drafting alternatives for Framework 68. Originally, we were targeting a final decision in September, but back on June 9th, the Executive Committee discussed pushing final decision past September, so that would then likely be April of 2027. Key thing about that is if you take action next year, then obviously we won't be using the new control rules in Framework 74, which is setting specifications for 2027 and some future years. Including the updated National Standard 1 guidance for phased in ABCs and for ABC carryover, phasing in ABCs is certainly something that can foster industry stability by trying to minimize jumps in changes in ABCs from year to year. There are limitations on how many years that can be in those guidelines. Also, it's possible to allow carryover of ABC, but only if it's explicitly included in the FMP. Currently, you have some carryover provisions that are limited to sector ACEs, but that is distinct from having carryover at the ABC level. And then in terms of constant ABCs, following the 2022 management track assessments, the PDT reflected on its work and developed a draft list of criteria to consider when deciding to develop constant ABCs. And so typically constant ABCs mean holding year one of a projected ABC constant when the ABCs in year two and three would otherwise increase. If recent recruitment is low, projections that are overly optimistic could overestimate SSB for those future years. And so the current draft list developed for when to consider constant ABCs are when a stock's in a rebuilding plan, and particularly when the stock is near the end of its rebuilding plan, when a stock is approaching overfished condition, when a high level of uncertainty in the projections is anticipated, and when a stock is recently considered rebuilt in order to help maintain that status in the new specifications period. So that's your history and update on next steps for Framework 68 and how it integrates with the risk policy work that you're doing. And that's the end of what I have on that. And next, I'll move on to the Amendment 23 review when you're ready, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that, Mr. Grant. So on Framework 68, ABC control rule modification, any questions on the presentation? Seeing none, on to what we all have been waiting for, Amendment 23 review.
I'm so excited people are anxious. That's no pressure at all. All right, so just to highlight that these slides are different than the ones sent out with your original binder. Those were an amalgamation of slides we presented to the committee and to the AP. This is definitely a higher level overview. So for today, you're gonna receive a review of the PDT's draft work. You're gonna have discussion. There is no decision to be made today. In terms of next steps, PDT is gonna complete its final written report in July. The council can consider future potential actions to modify the sector monitoring program. That would be discussed during the 2027 council priorities recommendation discussion later this year. And so, as I said, this is a high level report of the PDT's work. So I hope you consider this a sales pitch for the coming written report, which will be much more detailed. And just a heads up that some of the work remains in development. So moving ahead, just a quick bit on the timeline. Last June of 2025, we completed development of review metrics, and then the council paused work. We restarted that work late winter and spring this year to conduct the review. We're looking to complete the review now. We're reporting out to you today, and then next month you'll get that report. This is a bit of a busy slide, but I just want to sort of use this to give you context around what you're going to see in the rest of the presentation. So the PDT identified three review questions and themes that explore multiple aspects of the groundfish monitoring program and will evaluate how successful the program has been in its achieving its goals. I'm going to present information from most of these 20 metrics, and I'm going to present it grouped by these same themes. Just a note that data from the Maximized Retention EM program was excluded from the analyses because it didn't actually operate during the years that Amendment 23 was implemented. As mentioned yesterday, that remains an approved program. It's currently suspended, but that may be reconsidered in the near future based on evaluation work that's going on. So the data impacts theme looks at catch, bias, the exclusion of some trips from the ASM requirement, and the removal of management uncertainty buffers. The fishery impacts theme looks at the cost of the program overall for the National Marine Fisheries Service and for the industry. It also looks at potential changes to where fishing occurs and which ports are used as a way to evaluate potential spatial observer bias. The two metrics boxed in red regarding spatial and reporting area analysis are not yet complete, and I won't be presenting on those today, but I do expect to have them in the report. The program reach theme looks at vessel participation in monitoring programs in terms of at-sea monitoring or electronic monitoring. It looks at EM review rates, at-sea monitoring coverage targets, achieved coverage, and also details of how coverage was assigned and distributed as a way to look at coverage equitability. And we'll discuss the results of all three themes together at the end. And so just a reminder that the Amendment 23 goal was to improve documentation of catch, sometimes discussed in the documents as improved catch accounting. The first objective was to determine total catch and effort for each sector in the common pool of target or regulated species. And the second objective was to achieve coverage levels sufficient to minimize effects of potential monitoring bias to the extent possible. And then the rationale for the review was an evaluation of whether monitoring program is meeting the goal of improved accuracy of catch data while maximizing value and minimizing costs. And this was identified in Amendment 23, incorporation of a review to ensure the council evaluated the program to be sure the enhanced levels of monitoring data were working as intended and that the increased cost to industry were providing the expected benefits from improved accuracy and reduced potential for bias in catch data. So we're going to start with data impacts, and I'm going to start with the bottom line up front. These are the results, and then I'll present the supporting information on that. So the discard data source has shifted from primarily being calculated discards in 2018 to 2021 to being observed discards from ATSI monitoring and reviewed electronic monitoring in 2022 and 2024. The total amount of discards in terms of metric tons has declined from over 800 metric tons in 2018 to a low of just less than 500 metric tons in 2021, and it's been steady at slightly over 500 metric tons in 2022, 2023, and 2024. And this suggests that accuracy and precision of catch data has improved because we've moved from calculations to observed discards. There have been some important changes over time that affect the results and the interpretation of them. The databases that we use to give us the information that goes into the analyses, those have changed. The constraining stocks for the fishery have changed over time. Obviously, there were potential worldwide complications during the pandemic period. And obviously, the achieved coverage dramatically increased because that was the goal. So those do complicate conclusions for some of the analyses, and I just want to highlight that up front as we move through them. And again, some of the analysis work is still underway, but will be in that final written report. And just a note, the information about observed trips landing more total pounds, more ground fish pounds, and fewer non-ground fish pounds is very new analysis, and I won't be getting into that in detail today, but that too will be in the report. So, patterns of bias have declined. And so now I'm talking about the first metric, which is observer bias. And we're looking at work conducted by Paul Nitschke comparing landings and effort ratios between observed trips and unobserved trips. And it's an update of the work that he previously did as part of the Amendment 23 EIS. So the hypothesis underlying this was that if constraining stocks that produce incentives for observer effects are causing unseen discards of legal-sized fish on unobserved trips, then this should result in a difference in stock landings per unit effort ratios between observed and unobserved trips in the fishery. So prior to increasing coverage, we saw persistent bias patterns from 2012 through 2017 where observed trips landed more cod in the Gulf of Maine, less haddock on Georgia's Bank, less haddock in Stat Area 521, but more winter flounder in Stat Area 521. And those patterns have disappeared with increased coverage after the implementation of Amendment 23. And a comparison of allocated groundfish stock landings to effort ratios was done between the observed trips and the unobserved trips by broad stock area and by gear type, both gillnets and trawl gear. We focused on the Gulf of Maine broad stock area, the Georges Bank broad stock area, and Stat Area 521, inshore Georges Bank. And it's really interesting that the patterns are gone, right? So if that hypothesis was this was true, the incentives to discard were shown in those patterns in the past. And now with observer coverage greatly increased, we no longer see those patterns. So I just told you that bias patterns had disappeared. But importantly, bias continues. It's been minimized. So this is work that's been conducted by Chad Demarest that's looking at evaluating the observer effect. And it's also an update of work he previously did for the Amendment 23 EIS. This is a busy slide. Don't worry, I'm going to walk you through it. So this is looking at KAL. This is kept of all fish on trips. And we're looking at consistency between unobserved trips and then the difference between observed and unobserved trips. In particular, right here, we're looking at trawl vessels 2012 to 2014, so prior to implementation of Amendment 23. So the number of vessels with higher variance between trips increases when you compare each vessel's observed and unobserved trips than when you look at that same vessel's unobserved trips to each other. So in this graphic, each vertical bar is a distinct vessel. The gray bars show vessels that have less than a 10% observer effect. The green bars show vessels that have between a 10% and a 40% observer effect. And the red bars show vessels with a greater than a 40% observer effect. And just a note, a given vessel is not in the same place in each chart, so don't worry about that. So in the top panel, you're seeing lower differences, lower amounts of bias when you look at a given vessel's unobserved trips and compare them to one another. But in the lower one, we're comparing trips of observed and unobserved trips by individual vessels, and we see a significant difference in the average kept catch across the fleet. And this sort of visually isolates specific vessels driving that systemic bias that we saw in those previous slides. Well, I didn't do a graphic, but I talked about those patterns of bias that we had seen previously. So now let's look at what that looks like after Amendment 23. So again, we're looking at kept all. And again, at the top, we're comparing unobserved trips by a given vessel, individual vessels or individual bars. And then in the lower, we compare observed and unobserved trips for differences for those same vessels. So a key takeaway here is we continue to see observer bias, right? When you compare a given vessel's observed trips to that same vessel's unobserved trips, there's more variation than if you just looked at sets of unobserved trips by that given vessel. But the recent high coverage minimizes the overall impact on the data because there are so many fewer unobserved trips contributing to the overall catch. So the key thing here is we can still isolate bias at the vessel level, and we can still see there are greater differences between a vessel's observed and unobserved trips than just its unobserved trips, which tells us that bias has to do with being observed. And while this is just looking at kept all as a metric, we saw similar patterns across all of our metrics and time stanzas. And so in your written report, you'll see this broken out by trawl gear, gillnet gear, kept all, kept groundfish, kept non-groundfish, days absent, and even average groundfish price. In earlier years, observed trips generally had lower values reported for all metrics, except average groundfish price was higher on observed trips. All of those patterns have changed with increased coverage. So, at the vessel level, we still see bias on observed trips, but with fewer unobserved trips proportionally, we're minimizing the effect that bias is having on the fishery. Okay, so talk about magnitude of bias declining. Here, really, I'm showing impact of bias rather than magnitude, so that's my mistake in the headline, but on the graphic and smaller text, you'll see that's in there. Detecting a statistical difference is only the first step. That's what I showed you on that last slide. Understanding the scale of the impact on landings is probably more important. For example, is the observer effect driven by a large number of small vessels making minor adjustments between observed and unobserved trips? Or a small number of high capacity vessels that make drastic differences in behavior in ways that can influence catch estimates? So to try to look at that, Chad Demarest isolated vessels demonstrating extreme observer effects. Those are vessels with greater than 10% observer effect and those with greater than 40% shifts in the medians between observed and unobserved trips. And then he mapped those back to raw data to calculate the proportion of the total fleet catch in biomass that was accounted for by those biased vessels. So in these graphics, dashed lines are vessel counts, and solid lines are the proportion of the total that's driven by biased vessels. These plots are basically tracking trawl vessels on unobserved trips. The dark blue lines are vessels with greater than 10% bias. The light blue lines are vessels with greater than 40% bias. And those high bias vessels are a subset of all the vessels that have at least 10% bias. So what we see is a decline in the proportion of the total catch that's coming from vessels with the highest bias. But that reduction over time is due to fewer unobserved trips rather than less bias on the unobserved trips. We still see a substantial proportion of vessels with a bias of greater than 40% on unobserved trips. The other thing you can look for in these graphs is if the solid line sits significantly higher than the dashed line, bias is being systemically driven by high capacity vessels. We don't see that here, but that's another one of the things that we looked at. And so, again, this is a high-level sales pitch for what we're seeing. And then in the written report, you'll see this broken down in detail across various metrics and gears. All right, so now we're moving on to the question of, can coverage address bias? And yes, you can address bias with coverage. So this is looking at estimating observer coverage needs through simulation. This is new work done by Dr. Deb Dewitt, largely from her recent dissertation work. And the goal here is finding the minimum coverage level that meets your criteria, in this case, minimizing bias. So this work, and this will be laid out in detail in your report, gives us a framework for estimating the necessary coverage rate using simulations that include intentional bias. And that means to do this requires an estimated range of observer bias, and that's a management decision. That's something that comes from the council. You know, the question is, can you put realistic bounds on bias estimate? And so this method, one thing it does is accounts for both bias and variance, whereas the traditional CV calculations we used prior to Amendment 23 only accounted for variance and not for bias, which was part of why we undertook all the things that we did in Amendment 23. So to use this approach requires a clear precision target. You've got to define that precision target as a probability statement. Could be something as simple as the 30% CV, but it could be something else. So for example, what does a 30% CV mean? It's roughly equivalent to saying that 90% of the simulations produce discard estimates that are within plus or minus 50% of the true discard amount. So looking at this, your left axis is the minimum coverage necessary to estimate discards with a CV30. Across the bottom axis is the assumed discard multiplier. And again, selecting that multiplier, that's a qualitative decision, but that can be informed by both data and other quantitative analyses. So for sectors, the issue is illegal discarding of large legal-sized fish that should have been retained rather than underreporting small fish below the minimum size. I'm not saying problem is in, I'm asserting that is what's happening. I'm saying that's the issue that you need to address if you're worried about bias affecting your discards. Because of this, a small number of illegally discarded large fish could actually overwhelm the legal discards of small fish because we're talking about differences in mass per fish. Looking at this curve, you can see that the curve is similar for each species. And then black and white is sort of the average across the species, but there's a change point around a discard multiplier of 3. And then again, sales pitch for the more detailed report, you can simulate other effects besides a multiplier for discards. You could do an add multiplier of known kept catch for each trip. You could look at other scenarios, but this is what we started looking at as a PDT to try to determine if coverage can address bias. So moving on to discard estimates for sector trips. This is work done by Laura Smith, and the focus here is showing that the source of discard data for commercial groundfish sector trips has shifted from predominantly being calculated using discard rates in 2018 to 2021 to primarily being observed discards in 2022 to 2024. And that suggests that accuracy and precision of your catch data has improved because you're not estimating so much of your discards. Similar trends are apparent at the stock level, and that will also be in the report. So in this graphic, your left axis is the amount of discards in metric tons. The bottom axis is the fishing year. Yellow discards are calculated discards for unobserved trips using a discard rate derived from observed trips. And those discard rates are sector stock and gear-specific discard rates. That's how the sector system operates. Green, blue, and purple colors are observed discards from different programs. So green are from the NEFOP program, lighter blue are observed discards from reviewed EM footage, darker blue are discards adjusted from VTRs using vessel-specific correction factors from the audit EM model, and then darkest purple are observed discards from the ASM program. In the paper, we'll group ASM and NEFOP next to each other in the figures to make it easier to group human observed versus electronic observed. And here you'll also see the total amount of discards has declined, but really what we're focused on is that change in the color bars, that you've been able to move away from most of your discards being estimated on unobserved trips to most of your discards coming from direct observation or adjustments from EM observation. Looking at discards as a percentage of kept catch, because that matters, the ratio of discards to kept catch has fluctuated between about 1% and about 2.5%. And so in this graphic, your x-axis is the proportion of discards to total kept catch. And this is calculated as the total annual groundfish discards divided by the total annual kept all. On the left, your y-axis, that top line is 2.5%. And groundfish discards have been less than 1,000 metric tons since 2018, and total kept catch has been less than 30,000 metric tons since 2021. Increased coverage began in 2022, and so you get really accurate estimates of the proportion of discards to total kept catch in those later years here. All right, so moving on to trips that were excluded from at-sea monitoring, what we found is that they have lower groundfish discards than trips that are subject to the monitoring requirement. So this is our 10th metric, exclusion catch estimates, and basically we're looking at catch of regulated species on trips that are excluded from the monitoring requirement. Mean discard rates for both of the groups of trips excluded from at-sea monitoring are generally really close to the discard rates for standard fishing trips, for standard fishing trips, but that's because there are few ASM excluded trips that get NEFOP coverage. So most of those trips excluded from at-sea monitoring, sorry, my computer's running out of power. Let me plug it in and come back to you.
I know you just needed a break there for a moment, so just give us a moment here.
Sorry about that. All right, so looking at the trips that are excluded from at-sea monitoring, generally they have lower groundfish discards. So there are two types of trips that are excluded from the at-sea monitoring requirement. There are trips that fish exclusively west of 7130 and trips that exclusively fish with 10-inch or greater gill nets in either the inshore Georges Bank or the southern New England stock areas. It's challenging for us to identify the 7130 trips because on a vessel trip report, you provide a single point of latitude and longitude, and the exemption line does not line up with the statistical areas that are reported on VTRs. So to identify those trips, we used either the trip start hail or VTR statistical area if it was fully west of that 7130 line. There are a high number of trips in the stat areas that are divided by that 7130 line, and the business rules and limited compliance with the trip start hail made it really difficult to identify those trips. For the extra large mesh gillnet trips, we were able to identify those using the trip start hail. So those are the two groups of trips that we looked at. That's how we pulled the data. And the key thing here is that discards are really low of ground fish on those trips. So that supports the original hypothesis when the council excluded them from ATSI monitoring that they had a small catch of ground fish and they were not worth prioritizing for monitoring. However, there are difficulties in trying to monitor that because of those things we've talked about. All right, so one more slide on data impacts. This is a simple one, so it's a breather for all of you. This is just looking at management uncertainty buffers. So one of the provisions of Amendment 23 was that when the coverage target was set at 100%, the sector uncertainty buffers would be removed, increasing their ACEs. So in order to look at this, what we did was first look at the years that Amendment 23 was implemented, 2023 through 2025, whether or not the management uncertainty buffer was removed, and then what the effect was. And when we talk about effect, we're looking at realized revenue versus what the quota change model predicted revenue would be if the management uncertainty buffer was in place. So 2023, management uncertainty buffers were removed only for White Hake and for Gulf of Maine haddock. And that was because Framework 65 set a threshold for removing those two stocks management uncertainty buffers at 90% coverage target rather than the default 100%. And in 2023, the coverage target was 90%. So it was removed for just those two stocks. And what we saw was that groundfish revenue, total revenue, and operating profit were below predicted levels. So why was that? So the fishery experienced an uptick in landings and revenue during 2020 that had not previously been predicted. And then with those moderately higher levels of revenue in 2020 and 2021, that informed a quota change model that did the predictions for 2023. And what had been seen in 2020 and 2021 didn't continue. So the quota change model was overestimating what revenues would be. So the effect, we saw revenues that were less than we expected. But we think that was more of a projection artifact than not seeing a benefit from those two stocks. So why do I say that? Well, in 2023, sectors caught 86.1% of their allocation for Gulf of Maine haddock and 96.6% of their allocation for White Hake. So that implies those were highly utilized stocks and that removing the management uncertainty buffer for them was important to the fishery. So looking at 2024, coverage target was 100%, management uncertainty buffers removed for all allocated sector stocks. What did we see? Groundfish revenue, total revenue, and operating profit were all above the predicted levels if the management uncertainty had been in place or removed. And then in 2025, again, 100% coverage target, management uncertainty buffers were again removed. We saw groundfish revenue, total revenue, and operating profit all predicted to be higher with the management uncertainty buffer removed, but 2025 just ended. We don't have complete final data yet, so we'll continue to update that in the report. So other things that are worth noting here. We couldn't really look at how lease prices might have been affected by removing the management uncertainty buffers because we only have the actual lease prices that people paid in a given year, so there's no way to really evaluate how the lease prices for that year would have differed if the management uncertainty buffer had or had not been in place. So that's something that came up in some of our discussions through the APs and the committee, and I just wanted to highlight it here. And as I said, in the written report, you'll get far more detail on what we looked at for the effects of removing management uncertainty buffers. So next up, we are going to move on to fishery impacts. So again, bottom line up front, fishery impacts results. The cost of monitoring scale up with achieved coverage, but cost per observed ASM day increased about 6% after controlling for inflation. That means ASM has become more expensive over time. Electronic monitoring is more cost efficient than at-sea monitoring, but that is preliminary data. In 2010 to 2025, we saw a decline in active vessels, total days absent, total landings, groundfish landings, and non-groundfish landings. So we try to control for that in our work. And when it comes to spatial observer bias, as I said before, that work isn't ready yet, but will be in your written report. So total monitoring costs have increased, but only a portion of that is due to increased cost, even when controlling for inflation. It's primarily due to increased achieved coverage. EM is more cost efficient than at-sea monitoring per day absent, per completed trip, and per landed pound of fish. But that is preliminary data. So moving forward, monitoring costs scale with achieved coverage. And as I said, cost information is still a little drafty because it only recently became available. So I'm covering it at a high level today. The refined work is going to be included in detail in the report this summer. Also, I want to clarify on this slide that we're looking at total sea days rather than days absent. And we're looking at combined at-sea monitoring and electronic monitoring costs. And so here are your costs and your days monitored. You can see the increases going on there. But interesting, it's not always a direct increase of cost with the increase in days. You see, you know, 2023, 7.2 million days at 6.9 million. 2024, 7.4 million days at 6.6 million. So let's move a little forward. So EM is cheaper than human at-sea monitoring, less expensive per day absent than at-sea monitoring. Looking at the EM price per day shows decreasing trends since Amendment 23 was implemented, whereas at-sea monitoring prices for industry increased about 6%, even when controlling for inflation in that same period. And again, this is sea days rather than days absent because we use both in different analyses. So we'll make sure to highlight that in the report to make it most easy to understand what each analysis is presenting. EM is also less expensive per completed trip than human at-sea monitoring. The EM price per trip shows a decreasing trend since Amendment 23. And so if you look here, you can see at-sea monitoring trips and cost, and then that leads you to a cost per trip. And then again, for electronic monitoring, you see trips, cost, and then your cost per trip. And so for human at-sea monitoring, you're seeing over $2,000 per trip, and for electronic monitoring, you're seeing under $1,000. EM's also less expensive per pound than at-sea monitoring with humans. Price per pound landed has definitely fluctuated more for both EM and human at-sea monitoring, but cost per pound for human at-sea monitoring, 20 cents per pound, and cost per pound with electronic monitoring, 10 cents per pound. So that's a pretty dramatic difference, even with variation between both prices. Overall, industry at-sea monitoring costs increased. Cost per at-sea monitoring day absent increased by about 6%. Has a small overall effect on the total cost because it's overwhelmed by the increase in coverage and how that affects the total costs. For this, the sea day costs were those that were specified in the sector and provider contracts from 2023, 2024, and 2025. Those were applied to the ASM observed trips. And then the costs were compared to those from 2016 to 2018, and that was previous work, all of this done by Greg Ardini. And then for this, all the costs were normalized to $2,025 to take away the inflation of the U.S. dollar. And where available C-day costs were compared to the total human observer amounts reimbursed to the sectors. And then in these columns, these are averaged annual values. So before Amendment 23, coverage rate around 16%, cost per day absent $826. In 2023 to 2025, coverage at 83%, $879 per observed day absent. And so that's where you're seeing a 6% increase in actual price separate from the effect of having higher coverage, making the majority of that difference between $700,000 of costs before Amendment 23 and $4.4 million after Amendment 23. All right, so this is the last slide on this metric on fishery impacts. And the takeaway here, cost efficiency is complex. So right now, based on the work we've just done, EM is drastically cheaper across every single metric. Per trip, EM is nearly a fifth of the cost of human at sea monitoring, $608 per versus $2,768. Per pound of fish, EM costs half as much, 10 cents per pound versus 20 cents per pound. But if the vessels paid for their EM equipment before Amendment 23, that's not in these costs. So there's a potential there to be underestimating EM costs if you have to have a new vessel buy new equipment to join EM. Now, when I made this slide a week ago, it looked like EM adoption had plateaued, but just yesterday, the expert on this, KB, gave us information that showed EM continues to increase in uptake. And so that's good news, especially if EM is more cost efficient, that more vessels are taking up EM. Most EM vessels to date fish shorter trips and less volumes than the vessels that opt into human at sea monitoring, which could imply that if the vessels that have already opted into EM are the best candidates, then trying to expand EM to other vessels might have higher costs for the metrics than what we've seen to date. And also what we heard from KB yesterday was not only were we seeing EM adoption continue to increase, but we're now also seeing more multi-day vessels adopting EM and not just day trip vessels. All right, so let's move on to program reach. And again, we'll start bottom line up front with some results. Expanding monitoring succeeded. We've got the highest monitoring coverage ever. Targets have been between 90% and 100% since implementing Amendment 23, and achieved coverage has been between 81% and 86%. Management uncertainty buffers removed for summer all stocks each year. Provider trip acceptance has increased and become less variable, and that's, you know, when a vessel is selected for coverage, does their provider actually cover that trip? PT&S compliance has been between 95% and 97%. Trip cancellations have been minor. Incident reports increase with coverage, but the proportions have been consistent. Waivers from coverage have declined, with most waivers now given are related to safety. Achieved coverage generally increases with the increased target, but it does vary between sectors. And then coverage equitability is subjective and up to the council to determine. So let's dig into those results. So since 2022, the coverage target has increased with a corresponding increase in achieved coverage. And this is a huge success. Any of you who have been on or around the water know there are a lot of logistics involved with vessels and people and putting them together. And that is the same for monitoring, perhaps more so. So this was very impressive response by the program to the council's decision to increase coverage. As we said, since 2023, the management uncertainty buffers have been removed for summer all stocks because of those high coverage targets, and those saw the benefits we talked about previously. 2022 was the only year that congressional appropriations limited the target to less than 100%. 2022 was a bit of an outlier. The congressional appropriation language that year, it was the first time it stated that of the money allocated to the agency for monitoring, a certain portion of that had to go directly to industry. In previous years, NIMS had been able to use more of the overall appropriation to support the program's infrastructure. NIMS initially reduced the target coverage to 60% that year, but then was able and permitted to use money from a different fiscal year to support the infrastructure, which allowed it to ultimately target the fishery at a higher rate. And in 2023, NIMS also received additional money to offset shoreside costs, allowing it to raise coverage targets to 90% in that year, and then it's been 100% target each year since then. So achieved coverage tracks the target. These graphics are showing achieved coverage by sector and by year. Achieved or realized coverage rates are variable between the sectors, but generally you see them go up when the coverage target goes up. And the realized coverage rate is generally only slightly behind the target, with 2020 being a standout exception because of COVID-19 impacts. So to look at coverage equity at the sector level, we compared the realized coverage rates to an expected coverage distribution for all sectors. What does that mean? In a simplified way, we looked at what the coverage target was, what did we then expect to be the achieved coverage, and then you compare sectors to that expected achieved coverage. Now, Amendment 23 very specifically set coverage targets at the sector level, which means the program is administered that way. That's what I'm showing here. The report will also contain analyses looking at coverage within sectors and then between vessels at a fleet-wide level. So in these graphics, the red line is the target coverage, the blue line is the expected achieved level, and then you can see sectors within the expected range are what we consider equitably covered, and then sectors outside of that range are above or below that basic measure of equity. As target coverage increases, most sectors were statistically underperforming their expected coverage rate. But, you know, at 100% coverage, everyone underperforms because it's impossible to achieve that when you allow waivers. So don't overinterpret that as saying that it's not working well. Acceptance rates are also increasing. So here we're talking about providers accepting the selected trips for the sectors that have contracted with them. And what we see is that's increased throughout the time series and it becomes less variable. So how do we see that? Well, the shorter length of each violin in the plot and then the widening of the area around 100% at the top, that's showing the shorter length is less variability. And that widening at the top is more of them getting closer to 100% acceptance of the trips that are selected for coverage. So that reflects well on the operations of the contracted providers handling the at-sea monitoring target as it went up. What else do I want to say on this one? Well, just highlighting here, there are two types of PTNS notifications, fixed on the left and flex on the right. Fixed trips, these are typically day trips, and so when you set the day for that trip to occur, you can't delay it. You either go on it or you cancel it. Flex trips tend to be multi-day trips, and it is possible to delay the start date of that trip rather than having to cancel it. But in both, we're seeing the same trend of acceptance rates increasing. All right, so let's talk about waivers from coverage. Most waivers are for safety. And similar to before, what we're looking at here is using colors to denote different things making up a total. So the darkest colors are trips that were covered, blue trips were trips that were missed, and then lighter colors represent waivers of different types. So starting in 2018 on the left and making it to 2025 on the right, what do we see? Most trips are now covered. Very few trips are missed, and then a smaller subset of trips are waived. There's also been a large shift in the dominance of waiver types between pre- and post-Amendment 23. Prior to Amendment 23, random waivers made up the majority of outcomes, and that makes sense when your coverage target is significantly less than 100%. A lot of them are randomly not selected for coverage. Now with 100% coverage target, generally all trips are selected, and therefore, where do the waivers come from? Generally speaking, they're coming from safety waivers. We also looked at the count of waivers compared to what you would expect across the two coverage periods and found that those safety waivers increased 3 times above expected values. Also of note was the decrease in provider waivers, which gets back to the acceptance rate. And so there were very few instances now where the provider waived a trip because they couldn't provide coverage. And let's face it, higher coverage means you've got to put providers on more trips. There was a slight increase in administrative waivers and missed trips, but we're talking about less than 1% of sailed trips, so it's not considered significant. It's also a slight increase in non-compliant trips, but as we saw in that previous slide, the average rate of non-compliance has still remained consistent across fishing years, 95 to 97%, which is really spectacular. Okay, refusals and incident reports. The program is seeing more incident reports, but that's really the result of increased coverage, more trips getting coverage. The proportion of the types of incidents has remained relatively constant. A majority of the incident reports are related to minor health and wellness concerns. And in 2022, they added EM-related incident types, which correlated to the increase in those incident types post-Amendment 23. And we also examined pre- and post-Amendment 23 coverage refusals, but found very few refusals, making it hard to contextualize that data at all. Instead, for these analyses, we consider refusals as part of vessel cooperation, trip setup in terms of an incident type. And that was the only group that saw a significant change across the coverage periods. So continues to support low rate of refusals after Amendment 23 implemented. Sorry, missed that one. I guess that's a two-part slide. That must be what the star means. Hard lesson learned. Sorry about that. So again, what we're looking at here are refusals and types of incident reports. That's what the color bars are showing. The dark bars at the top are related to vessel cooperation. And then moving down, you get to safety concerns, and then down to regulatory violations, electronic monitoring, and yellow is just the all gap of other. Like I said, minor changes were seen in the other incident groups during each coverage period, but none were statistically different across the coverage periods. All right, so as we said, PT&S compliance is consistently high, and that's fleet-wide. The range of fishing year means was only between 95 and 97%. That's really good consistency. A couple of sectors fall below the annual mean, but for the most part, sectors are clustered around that 100% compliance. And that's not really a surprise. The PT&S requirement has been in place for the fleet since 2010. And they've had plenty of time to learn the system and be compliant. PT&S outreach when you do have a non-compliant vessel has also historically been very effective. So what are we seeing on this graph? Your y-axis is compliance rate with 100% at the top. X-axis is year, the dots are the individual sectors, and as I said, you see clustered up there near the top, close to 100%, the sectors each year. Cancellation rates have declined, and what we're showing here is the ratio of vessel-initiated cancellations to agency-initiated cancellations. What does that mean? It means now you see a greater proportion of the cancellations proportionally coming from the agency rather than from the vessel. And in this, the data is aggregated by sector. Cancellation rates for fixed trips have been gradually increasing. Not a surprise, those fixed trips you either sail or cancel because they're day trips. Flex trip cancellations are more sporadic, and that's because they have the ability to delay those trips. We also saw that the frequency of the time when vessels would cancel a trip for both waived and selected trips, we looked at that, and there are two peaks that we found. There's one peak between 0 and 24 hours before sailing. Those are likely operational cancellations, whether it's weather, gear, equipment failure, something like that. The other peak was seen between 24 and 48 hours ahead of a trip, and that correlates highly with the time when observers get assigned to given trips. But cancellations, we're not seeing a trend of increased cancellations. We're seeing a trend of decreased cancellations. Coverage is more equitable, and this is looking fleet-wide coverage by vessels. And so while achieved coverage varies more among individual vessels, again, we conducted the analysis at the sector level to be consistent with the design of the monitoring program. And the color gradient here, roughly analogous to a single standard deviation, and we're using it to measure variability. In 2003 through 2025, equitability between sectors improved. We compared the same distribution fleet-wide and at the vessel level and found a similar trend of increased underperformance when compared to the expected coverage rate as the target rate increased. But again, when your coverage target is 100%, there's no real expected range because you're trying to cover them all, but that's impossible in a world where we issue waivers. So if you have any trip missed, it causes a vessel or a sector to underperform. But really your takeaway here is the reduction in those dark colors at either side. So on the left, where you get into the darker reds, these are sectors underperforming by one or more standard deviations from the expectation. And on the right, you're seeing sectors with the darker blue getting covered higher by one or more standard deviations than you would have expected. And your takeaway is that we moved to these higher coverage targets, 2023, 2024, 2025. We're seeing that start to evaporate because we're getting more equitable coverage, generally speaking. All right, so ASM versus EM. What we generally see is a decrease in at-sea monitoring use by humans and an increase in electronic monitoring. What I need to tell you is that the EM numbers for 23, 24, and 25 are wrong because we got better information yesterday from KB. So in 2023, we actually had 25 EM vessels, and in 2024, we had 36 EM vessels. 2025, we had 43 EM vessels. So we're seeing EM continuing to increase in its adoption by vessels while we're seeing fewer vessels using human at-sea monitoring. Primarily, we're seeing bottom otter trawl using EM, but we are also starting to see more multi-day vessels and not just day trip vessels adopting EM in the most recent years. And one thing we did look for, there were zero vessels that had neither human at-sea monitoring nor EM, but did have NEFOP. So that suggests we're not missing any vessels. So this is good news. We're seeing an increased adoption of EM, which is nice. Why? Well, because it appears EM is a lot less expensive. So historically, what we have seen are that smaller vessels choose electronic monitoring. And so what we're looking at here are the number of vessels participating in human at-sea monitoring or electronic monitoring by length in each fishing year. We don't see vessels over 75 feet use electronic monitoring. It's beyond the scope of this report to determine why, but one hypothesis is that the audit model is not considered practical on high volume vessels. use of EM has been increasing among vessels in the 50 to 75 foot range, and EM adoption has been pretty consistent for vessels under 50 feet. It might be worth correlating this to the number of active vessels in each size class. It's not something we've done yet. Could be something worth looking into in the future. And then for the report, we're considering how to best display this information as a figure, not just a table of numbers. So if folks have thoughts on that, we'd certainly be happy to have that to make sure the report is as useful as possible for you. An option for this might be using bar graphs to try to show active vessels in each size class and then those choosing human at sea monitoring versus electronic monitoring. And then a bit more about electronic monitoring review rates. So EM review rates are performance-based. What I'm showing here is the review rate for vessels by fishing year, and in the first column for that for experienced vessels, vessels that have already been in the EM program coming into this year, and then what the coverage or review rate is for new vessels to EM. And so you'll see in 2021, it was a review rate of 50%, whether the vessel was new or experienced. Starting in 2022, kept a 50% review rate for new vessels in their first year, but experienced vessels that had already been in the program were reduced to a 35% review rate. What you don't see in those numbers is that each year since implementation, NIMS has refined the approach to setting the video review rates. So the goal is to set individual performance-based review rates to ensure sufficiently precise discard estimates. The basis comes from some work back done in 2021 using data from 2017 to 2020. That analysis is what originally determined that 35% was the minimum realized review rate required to achieve an acceptable level of confidence in the discard estimates. And so what happens now is that if a vessel has a trip that's reviewed, but the review fails, another trip is selected to make sure that 35% or 50% of the reviewed trips are passing, or that 35 or 50% of trips are reviewed and pass. And that's important because that review is telling you that EM is successful on that vessel. And so it's not just how many trips you're reviewing, but what percentage of the reviewed trips are passing that review. And then how is EM being used? Well, the audit model is the one model currently being used, and that has what is called a Delta model. And the Delta model's a framework developed to correct for bias and self-reporting of discards on VTRs. So basically, if you're using the audit model, you've got EM, you're providing your discards on the vessel trip report, and then the EM data is used to develop a correction factor specific to that vessel to make sure that what's reported on the EVTR for that vessel, for that trip, is reflecting the actual discards for that vessel. And that is a correction factor applied, and those are vessel specific. So that has been a very high level review of a lot of complicated work. As I said, there will be a much more complex and detailed written report coming to you in July. And so I'm going to quick go back over results, and then I will stop there and turn it back to the chair. So from a data impact results, observer bias has declined. It's not eliminated, but it's ameliorated by high coverage. The past patterns of catch bias have disappeared under high coverage, but individual vessels still show bias on unobserved trips. Accuracy and precision of catch data has improved, and that's because most discards are now observed rather than calculated. We've confirmed that the trips that are excluded from the at-sea monitoring requirement do have lower discard rates than other trips. There's no single coverage target less than 100% to address bias, but there is an approach to set coverage based on expected bias. Fishery impacts results. Total monitoring costs have increased. It's primarily due to the increased achieved coverage, but we do see industry costs per observed at-sea monitoring day increase by 6%, even when controlling for inflation. Preliminary data says electronic monitoring is more cost efficient than ASM per day absent, per completed trip, and per landed pound. And we still haven't provided you with our work on spatial observer bias, but that will be in the report. And then for program reach, expansion of monitoring succeeded, highest coverage achieved ever. Targets have been between 90 and 100%, achieved coverage between 81 and 86%. The management uncertainty buffers has been removed for some or all stocks each year since implementing Amendment 23 because of that high coverage. We have seen benefits, positive economic benefits from that. Provider trip acceptance has increased and become less variable. That means the program is working well. PT&S compliance has been between 95% and 97%. That means industry is complying and that facilitates the program working. Trip cancellations are minor. Incident reports increase with coverage simply because there's more trips being covered that could have an incident, but the proportion of incidents types has remained consistent. Waivers have declined overall with increased coverage, and most waivers relate to safety. Achieved coverage increases with the target, but there is variation between sectors, and coverage equitability, as we've discussed, is subjective, and basically it will be up to the council to interpret that. So for today, you've had your review. There'll be time for discussion. The chair will moderate that. There's no decision for you to make today. Next steps, plan development team will complete that written report for you next month. And the council can consider potential future actions to modify the sector monitoring program, and that would be part of discussions for council priorities for 2027. And again, consider this high level presentation to be a sales pitch for the upcoming report. Mr. Chair.
That was a lot. I do appreciate your presentation, Mark. I do appreciate the work that the PDT did. There was a lot of things we put on the table. Actually, we had put a lot more on the table and we actually cut it back. So thank you for the work that you did. I know we're not looking for expected actions, but possibly a consensus statement that while we know the final report is not done yet, maybe that we can check the box that we did complete our 2026 priority on the Amendment 23 review, but I'll leave that up to the council if they want to go through that. Right now, I will go to the council for questions on the presentation. Ms. Ware.
All right. Maybe I'll start with slide 38. And I think I'm still trying to understand what the various lines are telling me, but my question today on this figure is, are the lines additive or are they cumulative? Because I think at the beginning of the time series, if I add like the two solid lines, it would be greater than 100%.
All right, so we've got two things going on here, and we can probably simplify this in the report to make it more readable and break this out into separate graphics. So what we're trying to look at here is the impact of bias. And so we've got dashed lines and solid lines. Let me just pull up and make sure I read them to you correctly instead of screwing it up from memory. All right, so the solid lines are the proportion driven by biased vessels. And then the colors for those, we've got, where is, dark blue are all vessels with at least a 10% bias. And then light blue are a subset of those. Those are vessels with at least a 40% bias. So yes, if you summed them, you could get over 100%. Because the vessels with a 40% bias are a subset of all those with at least a 10% bias.
Okay, so the green line vessels are also, the blue line vessels at 10% are also included in the green line with 40%.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Slide 40. So for the teal, the EM vessels, I'm curious what happens to EM vessels when their video is not reviewed. Would they be in the teal or in the yellow here?
Vessels that use EM are required to have EM turned on for 100% of their trips, so 100% of their trips are considered covered.
Okay, so all EM trips would be in the teal then?
Yes, they shouldn't be getting calculated discards.
Okay, and then my final question was slide 45. And I just wanted to better understand what the 7.4 million days. I don't know what the days are. That seems like a very high number.
I'm going to go ahead and speculate that those should have been thousands and not millions, and that my dyslexia got the better of me when transcribing that from the report.
That sounds great. Thank you. I think I have a comment later on how we move forward, but I'll save that.
Thank you for that. Any further, Mr. Alexander?
Yeah, so I think it's slide 39 or 40, Mark. No, keep going back. Keep going back, sorry. Nope, back more. Right there. All right, so we don't operate in a static environment out there. Each tow's different. Each trip is different. Each day is different. Each tide is different. And we have so much variation in the amount of fish we catch from day to day to, I'm wondering if you've compared, like, the ground fish trips to another trawl fishery trip, that's observed and one that's not observed, because we have so much variation in how we catch fish that, I mean, if you look at my trip reports will be consistently 20% below where what I actually have on the deck, because I hate to overhaul. I hate to get in there and have more fish than what I think I do. And that's just a quirk of mine. But that's how they'll be consistently 15-20% below where my actual hail will be actually 15-20% below where what I actually take out. So I'm just wondering if you've done any comparison to see how the ground fish fleet would compare with any other trawl fishery. I don't care what it is, you know, to see if to kind of ground truth the bias estimates, because we will never get to 0% bias in the ground fish fishery or any trawl fishery if that's what we're looking for, you know what I mean? So anyway, just a thought, something for the future, I guess.
We had significant input on what the review was. I agree that's a good point, but I don't think that would be something incorporated into the final report because, let's face it, they got a whole other list of things that we just gave to them to do moving forward. So great thought, but that would be something moving forward. Mr. Hansen, yes, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mark. It was an awful lot of information. I got a couple of questions. First one's on slide 43, where you're talking about the removal of management uncertainty, and it affects profit, basically. It shows that the revenue is increased over what was expected. But profit and revenue is a function of the markets. I'm just curious if this relates directly to utilization. I think utilization might be a better metric to use for this comparison, but I just, you know, if you can clarify that for me, I'd appreciate it.
In this, we generally tried to look at revenues, because one of the things we generally do as part of any action is we use our quota change model to try to look at what we expect will happen. Obviously, one of the things we can't control is what future prices will be in markets, so that's always a limiting factor. But it was one way we had to try to control as much as we could, just trying to be specific to what was the difference with and without the uncertainty buffer, because it's really hard to hindcast that as well. We only particularly looked at utilization in 2023 because we were looking at two stocks, and we knew that it was a year that we didn't have much confidence in the quota change model because it was informed by the very unusual 2020. We could relatively easily look at stock utilization by year. That's not a difficult thing to pull, and certainly provide that information. And we certainly see every year some stocks have a higher utilization than others because they're just in more demand. We could certainly provide that, but it's still up to interpretation then if you feel that that utilization was strictly because more is available or unexpected market effects, et cetera.
Okay, the second question is probably a little easier. Slide 55, you're talking about non-compliance for PTNS at 95 to 97% compliant rate. What's the penalty for non-compliance? Because it should be 100%. It's a simple logging in to before your trip. What are the reasons for the non-compliance? Is it just negligence, or is some of this intentional?
I'll defer if agency folks would like to get into it directly. Typically, my understanding has been that there is very little intentional non-compliance. It's far more frequent for vessels that participate in the fishery less frequently, or that participate only seasonally. When they start back up, they might miss a trip or not get it perfectly correct. And so I think I noted on one of the slides, they find that outreach generally resolves that in almost every case rather than needing something on an enforcement level, because it tends to be unintentional noncompliance more so than willful.
Okay, that's helpful. I mean, as long as it's unintentional and not something that one vessel does every trip, which could still be 95% compliance because everybody else does, but that one vessel, if that was the case, would probably be profiting pretty well because he's doing things he shouldn't be. But thank you for that. But a lot of information and a great report.
Before I go on to other, because I see my list is kind of getting a little long here, we're actually quite a bit behind schedule. We do have a significant presentation after on risk policy. I want to make sure there's some clarifying questions on the presentation. Obviously, there's going to be a final report that will come back, obviously a little more in-depth discussion at the Groundfish Committee. I'm obviously not going to look for a consensus statement. So if there's any couple clarifying questions on the presentation, I'll just kind of go there. So I will turn to you, Mr. Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'll cross two or three of the questions I have off my list and just have three or four to go through. I'll be quick. The management uncertainty buffer slide, can you go back to that? I just want to make sure I understand what's being presented in that. And while you get to it, is it that the removal of the management uncertainty buffer resulted in an increase in 2024, an increase in projected revenues, profits, et cetera? Is that what that was showing? I think you might have just went past it. Yeah, so 2024, for example, what are those numbers saying exactly?
That it's a fair question. There's a lot that I snuck in there, and only I have the footnotes. So in effect, what we're looking at is realized revenue versus what the quota change model predicted the revenue was going to be with the management uncertainty buffer in place. And so, as I said, quota change model is something that we use in analysis of every action where we're trying to look at expected economic effects of what the quotas will be. It looks at them holistically across trips, et cetera. And so generally, the quarter change model predicts what we think revenues will be, and that's groundfish revenue, total revenue, operating profit, with the management uncertainty buffers in place. And so we used that, let's say, as our control. And then in the years that we removed that uncertainty buffer, we took the actual revenues and compared them to that prediction as one way to try to look for what the true effect was of having removed that management uncertainty buffer. So in 2023, all the achieved numbers were less than had been predicted, but we think that's because at that time, the quota change model was using information from 2020 to inform it. And 2020, in retrospect, was an outlier year in terms of values. And then in 2024 and 2025, when we looked at the realized revenues and compared it to what the quota change model predicted would happen if the buffer was in place, we saw groundfish revenue above predicted, total revenue above predicted, operating profit above predicted. And so we take that as a positive. But yes, due to all the things you can't control, global effects on price or demand for a thing, teasing it all out to say this is strictly because of that management uncertainty buffer is difficult, but it is a tool that we had.
Thank you for that. The second one...
I'll cut you off there, Mr. Smith. Thank you. I'm sorry. We are significantly behind time. I have Mr. Whelan, one question.
Just one question. And, you know, I think in another 10 years, we probably won't have observers on the boat. It'll be all electronic monitoring. I think it would be helpful to put in the presentation what the actual cost of the equipment is and the depreciation. So you can do an apples to apples kind of comparison, because obviously as things go on and get cheaper, electronic monitoring is going to be very cheap to do on a vessel. And I just think that would kind of help jump us ahead, because that's where we're going. In another 10 years, we're going to not have any observers on board. It'll all be electronic monitoring. So I think that would be helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. I think we can do that because we do have the cost information.
Ms. O'Dell, one question. The last question.
I don't even know where to start, honestly. This is a lot of information, and I really appreciate your presentation, Mark, but there is so much here. I'm glad to hear that the Groundfish Committee will discuss this in August. I'm glad to hear we're going to get the report in July to be able to take our time and fully digest it and understand this. There's been recommendations that have come out of the committee to not just have figures, but to actually have tables with numbers. Live, the PDT met with the sector managers. I hope that the advice that they provided as well is being included in these analyses. So I think if you're looking for a consensus statement, I'm not going to support it. Because
there will be no consensus.
Okay, thank you. To be continued then. And thank you for the work that you've done to date. And we look forward to getting the final report.
Thank you for that. And, you know, I appreciate there was a lot of more questions I wanted, but we are behind time. I would just make one final recommendation. As Ms. O'Dell said, the PDT, a subset, had met with sector managers. I would strongly encourage that to happen again. As a sector manager, I find some of your conclusions and some of your presentations to be very faulty, to be honest. And I'm not trying to be, well, yeah, I am critical, but I want to make a product that this council can use to go forward with. So I encourage that. I thank you again. I will turn to Mr. Pappalardo. Do you have anything else with Groundfish Committee? Thank you. We will take a five minute break, and we will be back for risk policy at 3:50. Thank you.
Hmm?